This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Even among proponents of drug legalization, Columbia University neuroscientist Carl Hart stands apart for his unflinching honesty. I am now entering my fifth year as a regular heroin user, the 54-year-old full professor writes in Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. I do not, he says, have a drug use problem, never have. Each day I meet my parental, personal, and professional responsibilities. I pay my taxes, serve as a volunteer in my community, and contribute to the global community as an informed and engaged citizen. I am better for my drug use. In a wide-ranging conversation with me, Hart, who is also a military veteran, makes the case that responsible adults should be free to buy, sell, and use whatever substances they want to, and that policy discussions about drug use have been polluted by bad information and moral posturing. He marshals an impressive body of academic research showing that virtually all currently illegal drugs can be and are used safely by millions of Americans, that drug prohibition has little or nothing to do with public safety, and that the United States would be a better place if its citizens were allowed to consume a much broader set of substances for pleasure. The Declaration of Independence guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all of us, he says, as long as we don't disrupt anybody else's ability to do the same. That means we get to live our life as we choose, as we see fit. Taking drugs can be part of that and is a part of that for a lot of Americans. Get ready for a conversation that will blow your mind. Here is The Reason Interview with Carl Hart. Carl Hart, thanks for talking to Reason.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Give me the elevator pitch of the book, Drug Use for Grownups.
Well, the elevator pitch is found in the subtitle, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. What I'm trying to do is ask Americans to think about their own liberty and not in this jingoistic, false patriotic sense, but in terms of what the Declaration of Independence guaranteed. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all of us, as long as we don't disrupt anybody else's ability to do the same. That means we get to live our life as we choose, as we see fit. And taking drugs can be a part of that. And it is a part of that for a lot of Americans. And so here I'm trying to show people that our promise, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, is inconsistent with our practice, this war on drugs, mm-hmm. this banning of drugs that people use in their pursuit of happiness as an expression of their liberty.
Yeah. And, you know, you point out in the book that, of course, we're using drugs all the time. I mean, whether it's caffeine or alcohol or tobacco. And then, you know, we have what the government calls illicit drugs. What is, are there any drugs that you would say are bad, that should be banned?
There are some drugs which we try to identify that are toxic. There's a drug called MPTP that we banned in the 80s because we found out that it destroyed specific brain cells. And that's good to ban those kind of drugs that are, and no one's seeking those drugs for their effects. Even when people accidentally made MPTP, they were seeking heroin. If heroin was available, nobody would be interested in MPTP. Sure, there are drugs that we learn that are so toxic that we have to ban them. But certainly drugs like cocaine, heroin, MDMA, none of those drugs are anywhere near that category.
Right. And we're going to talk, even the way that you talked about, the pursuit of happiness involving recreational use of drugs, you know, is provocative. And you talk in the book that you were writing the book, you were in your fifth year of using heroin, which most people that, you know, just blows people's minds, the idea that you could be a heroin user and something other than a homeless person. We're going to get to that in a bit. But first, define, you know, drug use for grownups. How are you defining grownups here?
Yeah, so that's one thing that I lay out in the prologue is that this book is for grownups. And I mean people who are responsible. They handle their responsibilities. They are members of their community. They participate in their community. People who are autonomous, people who are responsible, that's who I'm defining as adults. I wanted to make it clear that this book is not for people who are immature, who are not handling their responsibilities, because they are not handling their responsibilities before drug use. They will be irresponsible after drug use. But what will happen is that people will blame drugs, when in fact, drugs had nothing to do with it. You just have an irresponsible person.
What in the book you talk about, you know, even with drugs like, say, methamphetamine and heroin, you know, two of the, you know, the biggest bugaboo drug words in, you know, that a relatively low number of people actually develop what would pass for addiction, according to the DSM-5. Or even substance use disorder. What range of problem use comes out of these drugs?
When we think about something like methamphetamine, it's been documented about 5 to 10% of the people who try methamphetamine will meet criteria for addiction, according to the DSM. Mm-hmm. Something like heroin, somewhere between 20 and 30% of the people who try heroin will become addicted, mm-hmm. according to the DSM. And so what can clearly be seen is that the vast majority of those folks don't have problems related to addiction.
You write early on that it has taken me more than 2 decades to come out of the closet about my personal drug use. So 2 questions on that. What took so long and why now?
Frankly, what took so long is that I was a coward. I was afraid of the blowback that would occur if I said, oh, yeah, of course I do a little cocaine, MDMA, heroin. I was afraid of the blowback. And having traveled around the world for this book, I went to multiple countries, 5 continents. And one of the things that was clear is that there are millions of people using these drugs, but they're in the closet. And not only that, they are middle-class, responsible folks, the vast majority of them. But yet they're in the closet, and we also have this caricatured image of the drug user as being some irresponsible degenerate, which is not the case for most of the drug users. And so I had to take a long look in the mirror and say, all right, we're vilifying people who are outed as drug users for having been labeled a drug user. And here I am doing the same activity and I'm staying in the closet. What kind of man am I? And I wasn't happy with the person who I was looking at in the mirror. And so that helped to force me to get out of the closet. I no longer want to be a coward.
It's striking to me too, Charles Wininger, a therapist who just published a book called Listening to Ecstasy. He's 71 years old. He talked about coming out of the chemical closet. There definitely seems to be a moment now where people are talking, individuals are talking about their drug use, about their responsible drug use. We are clearly at what seems to be the beginning stages of the end of the drug war. I don't want to get too ahead of, you know, I don't want to declare victory in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, 20 years after recreational pot or medical marijuana and eventually recreational pot has been legalized in a bunch of places. What is going into the current moment that you and other people who are positions to lose, you know, status or possibly jobs and things like that? What's going on that we're having this conversation about drugs now?
I don't know what's going on for the moment. I know what's going on for me. I had to develop personally. I had to be confident in what I'm doing. I've studied drugs now for nearly 30 years. And I'm not talking about coming out of the closet about some chic drug use, like MDMA is kind of chic, or mm-hmm. some others, yeah. some psychedelic is chic. I'm talking about heroin, the thing that people fear, the thing that has been vilified. And so it's taken me a long time to develop as an adult, as a person, to develop the confidence. And so this is what my conscience kind of forced me to do, and not so much the moment, because I'm not as optimistic as you are about the end of the drug war. I understand that our economy, particularly after this pandemic and as a result of this pandemic, our economy is not doing well. And the drug war has always functioned as a reliable jobs program. And I suspect it would continue to function as a reliable jobs program, it will have even more importance as we come out of Corona.
Tell me a little bit, or spell out, how is the drug war a reliable jobs program? Because it certainly is that, but, kind of flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah. So let's go back to the 1970s when automobile companies and the big factories were starting to leave places like Michigan, Ohio, and factories were leaving West Virginia, even Maine, and throughout the 80s and 90s, and they went to other countries where they had cheaper labor. You had a large number of Americans who were making middle-class salaries. They felt like their personhood was being respected, and they had a role in their community. Take away those jobs, you take away that income, people can no longer take care of their family at the levels that they were. Now, when that happens, you have to figure out how to create some jobs that will replace the factory jobs. While the war on drugs, one of the things it did, we say that we lost the war on drugs, and when in fact there are some people who are winning handsomely as a result of the war on drugs. Law enforcement is one. Those jobs came while everybody else was having a hard time with employment. Law enforcement jobs were increasing. Those folks benefited. The medical community benefited with this focus on addiction. Over here, we'll treat you, we'll help you. People who run prisons, we built prisons and all of the industries that support the prisons, hotels, restaurants for people who are coming from out of town, the phone companies, all of those folks made out like bandits, politicians. They no longer had to wait to invest in some sort of program or skill set of the community that takes more than 2 to 4 years, which their term would be up. The war on drugs, they saw immediate results. They hired people and they can go brag about that. They won in this case. So the war on drugs is an effective and reliable drugs program. The problem is it's reliant upon the imprisonment of primarily Black and brown bodies. And that's the real problem and real shame of this.
Yeah. And, you lay out a kind of economic case for the drug war, or an economic basis, which is going to that's going to be really hard to unwind. I mean, if it's hard for us to get out of Afghanistan after 20 years, it's even harder to get us out of drug prohibition, after 50 or 70 years. But then you also in the book and in your previous book, High Price, you also talk about, there's an undeniable racial dimension to the war on drugs. And last year, you had a piece in the New York Times about George Floyd and talking about how, in many ways, the way he was discussed and his toxicology report, he brought to mind the fear of a kind of cocaine-crazed Negro. That was a very prevalent fear in the early 20th century, and that kind of racial fear infuses all discussion of that. Can you talk about the racial dimension to the war on drugs? And, where did that come from? And is that showing any sign of dissipating or moving to a better place?
Yeah, so when we think about why drugs like cocaine and heroin are banned in the United States, many people think that they're banned because of pharmacological reasons, because of the science. But really, these drugs are banned because their association in the media, in popular culture, with these undesired groups. Cocaine, Black people in that case, opioids, Chinese people in that case, even marijuana with Black people and Mexicans it was associated with, and that's why we banned these drugs. Race fanning the sort of racial fears in this country has always been a reliable way to galvanize certain Americans. That's why Donald Trump did so well. He would give a nod to these sort of the racial fears and the racial anxieties in our country, and people respond to that. And so the same is true with drugs today. Whenever you want to vilify someone, a group, a person, you associate them with a drug, and we say that that drug made them behave in a way that is inhumane, in a way that we can dehumanize that person. And once we dehumanize that person, that group, then we can do whatever we want to them. And I'm trying to take that away from, take that tool away from our folks who may have those racist proclivities.
So, you know, let's talk about heroin, because you not only you come out of the kind of chemical closet, not simply as somebody who smokes weed or does MDMA, but you talk about being a regular heroin user. Heroin, you know, conjures up all kinds of alarms for people. This is probably, you know, the strongest example of where, you know, if you even talk about heroin too much, you will become addicted to it without even trying it, much less if you try it, you're an instant addict. You know, the new drug of choice story always goes back to heroin, where it says, you know, taking heroin is like having 10,000 orgasms and you never want anything else. You use heroin. Talk about your use of it and, you know, why do you use it? Isn't it this dangerous, dangerous substance?
Yeah. So when I talk about my drug use, whether it's heroin, MDMA, or cocaine, I have to be careful in part because for so long in this country, we have been accustomed to talk about drugs like we were adolescents. We make these jokes and so forth. And so I want to be clear that my heroin use is just like my use, my sort of taking time out to go to a club to see a comedian perform or to go see a concert. I set aside that time for that activity and I enjoy that activity in that moment. And when that moment is over, I'm done. I have to go back and do whatever other responsibilities I have. So that's how I want people to understand my heroin use or any other uses is. Now you say, why do you use heroin? Why do people do alcohol? To unwind, to relax. The same is true with my heroin use. I use heroin in part because it's really good at helping me to unwind, to be more forgiving of other people, to look at my own behavior and see where I need to modify in order to be a more responsible person, in order to be a better person. I have to constantly evaluate the impact of my behavior on that of other people, especially people who are subordinate. I don't want to ever be the source of their anxiety such that it impacts negatively on their loved ones. I think about all of these things during those times when I use heroin. And so hopefully it helps to make me a better person because I can forget about some of the sort of petty things that I may have had in my mind and then holding those things against people. Instead, I learned how to be more forgiving and more magnanimous.
And I you know, let's push this a little bit. You have kids, you have a partner. This helps you. Does it help you be a better partner? Does it help you be a better father?
Absolutely. Oftentimes my drug use is with my partner. And so we have discussions about our kids. Our youngest kid is 20, but we, just like any other parents, we can be pain in the asses to our children. And so how can we be better parents? How can we support them in a more loving way, in a way that is more effective, in a way that is more acceptable, in a way that they find more helpful? So all of these things, I think about my parenting. I think about my role as a partner when I'm using. Absolutely.
How would you know that your heroin use is becoming problematic?
Oh,
because, you know, and this is one, you know, there are so many narratives around drug use. And it's like, of course, no heroin, you know, no junkie says I've got a problem until they're, you know, forced to face the fact or something. How would you know that it is not problematic?
I would know if it's problematic if, for example, I'm failing to meet my responsibilities that are important to me. Like you've written a book, you write a book, you have these deadlines, and I'm not making these deadlines but because I am, I don't know, hungover from some drug use, well, as heroin or something else. I'm not making these deadlines because I'm engaged in this behavior of using this drug when I should have been producing. I'm not meeting the obligations that I've made to my children. All of these things are indications for me that this is not good. And so I think about my productivity. I think about my being a responsible person, meeting those obligations, those deadlines, being there for people who are important to me in my life. When I start to fall short in those areas as a result of my drug use, then that has to go.
How do you take heroin? How do you, you know, and where do you get it? I don't want you to out your dealer. But, you know, how do you get it? And, you know, how do you consume it?
Yeah. So when we think about heroin, people oftentimes make this mistake in interviews. They say, oh, you shoot heroin, because we have connected heroin use with intravenous use only. Not that there's anything wrong with intravenous use, but I never have shot a drug simply because I understand that many people are seeking to get the sort of immediate rapid effect by putting a drug in your bloodstream. That's fine. You do heroin intranasally. And intranasally, there are blood vessels that go to the brain. So it gets there fast enough for me. I don't need to have it as rapid as shooting a drug or smoking a drug. I like to have a drug intranasal or orally because the onset of effects are slightly delayed, but they last longer. And I like to pace myself, and I like to time it out so that I am psychoactively altered for a certain amount of time, the time that I like to be altered. But that's part of knowing pharmacology and being a fan of pharmacology.
And I guess, but you obviously are a psychopharmacologist, so you know the duration and the effects and things like that. I was also going to say, as a parent, if your kid is 20 now, you finally, or one of your youngest kid is 20, you have time, right? Because you can't be doing drugs when your kids are young and you don't have if you got to take them to the next practice or school or whatever. It's
you hit it on the head.
It's all part of a process.
You hit it on the head, man. It's a beautiful thing to have your kids be adults, because now you have your life back, because you spent all your life raising them, making sure that they're good people and so forth, which is a lot of energy.
Do you have you done drugs with your kids?
No, I haven't done that.
You don't want to ruin it for them? Because, I mean, would anything be worse than doing drugs with your parents?
It might be, you know, but I'm not going to assume that my kids want to do drugs with me. You know, I recognize that I'm 54. My kids are in their 20s and 30s, and I may be unhip to them. And I'm not going to assume that I'm cool and hip, because what is considered hip today, it's not their father, and that's their thing. And I give them their space, and they give me mine.
When you were their age, and you are a veteran, a military veteran, as well as, you were in your earlier stages of your professional career, you were very anti-drug. Talk a little bit about where you came from, and then what changed so that you are, you know, now writing a book about responsible drug use?
Yeah, so I grew up in Miami in the 1960s, 1970s, and the early 80s. And crack was first reported in the national press, I guess, late 1984 in the LA Times first, and about a year later in the New York Times. And people blame crack for many of the problems that we saw in communities like the one from which I came. It was a predominantly Black, resource-poor community. If you know anything about the 80s, you know we hit record level of unemployment in 1982, before crack appeared, of course. But crack was blamed for this record number of unemployment. Crack was blamed for high murder rates. All of these things were going on before crack even hit the scene. And I believed that. And so I thought, like, oh, we get rid of crack, we get rid of the problems in my community, I'm a good person. I am contributing to the community. And so I spent my career trying to develop medications that would help people who were struggling with drug addiction. I thought if I learned something about the neurobiology, I could develop or manipulate the dopamine cells at that time in a way that would effectively make people not want cocaine. And of course, that was naive, but it took me damn near 30 years to recognize that that was naive.
You know, we're in an age now where, you know, one of the phrases you hear almost every day is, you know, we need to follow the science. Part of what your book does, I think, spectacularly well is point out that even among scientists, and this includes a younger version of yourself, you know, that science is really oftentimes, you know, it's really putting its thumb on the scale of like drugs are bad. All, you know, a drug like heroin, you know, automatically leads to addiction. You know, where does that come from? Because science is supposed to be impartial. Scientists are supposed to, you know, check their prejudices or their biases at the door. You know, why does that not happen more in discussions of drug, of the effects of drug, much less drug policy?
Well, the first thing we have to recognize is that science and scientists are not the same. So when we say science, we're talking about the data, follow the evidence, not the scientists, because the scientists are just like Thomas Jefferson, just like me. We're all flawed and we have our own biases. And the scientists, in terms of the war on drugs, their role is that they, including me, I include myself here, we have made out like bandits, because as long as we are exaggerating these harmful effects with drugs, that means that there's more money for grants investigating the harmful effects of drugs. And so we are incentivized to put our hands on the scale in a way that exaggerates the harmful effects associated with drugs. And so this is what you would expect. You give somebody an incentive to behave a certain way, guess what? They're going to behave a certain way.
In discussing opioids, opiates and opioids in your book, you talk about how there's a real bias towards saying that addiction is a brain disease, particularly an addiction to an opiate. Why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong because there's no evidence to support that. People have used brain imaging data to suggest that that's the case or to argue that that's the case. But in the book, I try to lay it out very carefully to people to show them where they are being manipulated. The bottom line is that if you take somebody who is clearly addicted to heroin, addicted to methamphetamine, whatever the drug is, you look at their brains and then you compare it to people or someone who's never used a drug, you'd be hard pressed to find any differences that would tell you, that would differentiate the two brains from the other. So like if you shuffled up these brains of people, these brain slides of people who are addicted to a drug versus those who never have used the drugs, you wouldn't be able to pick out an individual drug user or an addict, as they say, from those people who are not addicts. And I walk the reader through this in the book. I walk them through to show how they are manipulated. They are manipulated because the researchers typically say, oh, you see this area, it lights up. You see this conversation that we're having? This area in my brain is lighting up right now. You see when this person is having sex, this area is lighting up. You see when this person is stressed out, this same area is lighting up. It tells you nothing. That's why it's still the most important thing for us to look at when we think about addiction is the behavior of that individual.
In the book, you talk about psychedelics and using psychedelics. You're also, and there's clearly a kind of psychedelic renaissance going on. People are talking about the psychedelics in ways they really haven't for decades. It's gaining popularity. I mean, people like Michael Pollan, the author of How to Change Your Mind, wrote a book, you know, that was perfect for a kind of NPR mainstream crowd to say like, hey, psychedelics are pretty good. People like doing ayahuasca and, you know, going to expensive retreats. You're critical, not of psychedelics, but of the way that many people in the psychedelic community talk about drugs. Can you discuss your reservations about the way that some psychonauts or regular users of psychedelics kind of think about or talk about their drug use?
Yeah, to be clear, that when we think about psychonauts or this community, it's a huge community. And many people in that community are really good people, and they've been here at this fight for many years. I think about Rick Doblin as one of those folks who've been on the front line, putting himself out there in ways that many of us will never have, we never will. And so I want to be clear and careful not to lump people like Rick in this group. There are newbies, people who are newcomers to this area, the study of drugs, the sort of liking of drugs. And one of the things that they have done is to try to separate themselves and their use of their drugs from other people who use other drugs. And they've done that in a sense, in a way that prioritizes their drug use and their drugs of choice, as if we have this hierarchy. And I am asking people to not do that, because the reason why I use heroin, for example, are for the same reasons that you may use psilocybin. Whatever you choose and whatever any of us choose, we should fight for the rights of everyone to use their substance of their choice, not of my choice, but of their choice. And I was concerned, and I am concerned, that there is this sort of political positioning, if you will, where they're saying, this is a strategy that we're doing. We don't want to taint the reputation of our beloved ketamine or psilocybin or ayahuasca. We don't want to taint the reputation of ketamine with PCP, even though they're essentially the same drug. But they have these wildly different narratives around them. And so I am just trying to keep people honest who are new to this, those people who are enthusiastic and without understanding the people, the blood and sweat and tears that have been shed as a result of us getting to this moment.
I mean, one of the things that is incredibly both bracing and refreshing about the book is that you deny anybody the right to a kind of taste hierarchy, to say, well, you know what, like, you know, I'm doing cocaine and that's better than methamphetamine or something, that, or that I'm doing drugs because I am on a journey of spiritual discovery, whereas you're just using it to get high. How does that go over with people?
You know, Nick, man, I don't know how it goes over with people, because I just put this out, as you know, and It's hard for me to care how it goes over with people, because I learned that when I've been trying to position myself politically in a certain way, I'm always wrong. And so what I had to do was just continue to try to live like the man I think I am. And, you know, I'm not all the way there, and I'll just keep, that's my goal and my aim. That's all I'll do.
Talk a little bit more, not the politics within the kind of drug use movement or the, you know, anti-prohibition movement, but more broadly. I mean, you're talking about liberty for all. You mentioned throughout the book that liberty entails responsibility in the way that you're talking about, that we should be free to do drugs, but then we're going to be held responsible for our behavior on those. You mentioned that you you are starting to get into guns, into ownership of guns and whatnot. Do you have a politics that kind of encompasses what you're trying to achieve with the book and with the way that you're living right now?
Yeah, I guess if my politics is about the people. People who identify as Republicans, Democrats, whatever they, libertarians, whatever they identify as, I always find that kind of silly. My position changes depending upon the context, but it's led primarily about, it focuses on what serves the people. That's what I really am concerned about. I'm not concerned about being on the right side or somebody's side. I just want us to live up to our ideals. If we do that, we live up to our ideals, that means that I can live my life like I see fit. And if that means that I have to fight for other people to do the same, so be it. That's part of that responsibility. And so I just wish people would go back and just read the Declaration of Independence. It's such a short document. And that's the document, that's our sort of guiding post. That's what we're aiming to achieve. It's not the law. The laws are there to serve the Declaration and justice. And people act as if law are the great, or is the greatest principle. It's not. It's these ideals. And if people would understand that, if they really understood what Patrick Henry meant when he said, "Give me liberty or give me death," then they would understand what it means to be American.
And as I think I'm of a similar age of you, I remember the bathroom scrolls, "Give me Librium or give me meth," which was a play on Patrick Henry, right? And I think I know where I come down on those two drugs. But what do you do with the irresponsible drug users? You know, and obviously, this is not an unknown problem. We have people who drink and who drink problematically. I myself don't drink anymore because I'm a bad drinker. How do you deal with that 10 to 30% of people who develop substance abuse issues with a given substance?
Yeah, in the same way we deal with people who develop problems with alcohol. Actually, I hope we would do a better job. Our treatment in this country is horrible. In fact, I'm an expert in this area, and I don't know where I would send a loved one in this country for drug treatment. I'd probably send them to Switzerland, but not here. So it would be nice if we just simply treated the problem. That means that we have to look beyond the drug, because we know the majority of people who use that substance is not addicted, or they are that we know that for sure. And so that means you got to look beyond the drug, and you have to look at what's going on in that person's environment, what's going on with the person's biology, what's going on. Is the person in pain, physical pain, emotional pain? Does the person have a co-occurring psychiatric illness? Has the person recently been rendered unemployed or underemployed? What's going on in the person's life? We oftentimes don't do that. Instead, we just focus on the drug and we say, yeah, this is what heroin would do to you. That's not heroin. That's your economy. That's your economy doing that to people. But we never say that. We never blame GM for all of the carnage that we see in some of these communities. It's much more appetizing to blame heroin. When in fact, we should probably be looking at our companies, these large companies that rendered these communities in dire straits.
You know, in the November elections, Oregon in particular passed the law, the first of its kind, where they essentially decriminalized all, you know, possession of narcotics in relatively small amounts. There are other signs that the drug war is, people are rethinking it, questioning it. As I mentioned, marijuana, both recreational and medical, is widely legalized in many parts of the country. It's also all across across the world. More and more countries are kind of rethinking drug policy. You talk a lot about how Portugal decriminalized drugs. Over a decade ago, other countries have done similar things, all to good effect. Why do you think that is happening now, and what would accelerate that trend, and what might slow it down?
So let's just think about Portugal. They decriminalized drugs in 2000, 20 years ago.
You know, I have to say 2000 seems like 10 years ago to me.
But understand that places like Spain and other places had always had drug decriminalization. There are a number of countries that always had decriminalization. Portugal just had a really good marketing machine. And so we all know about Portugal. And so I think that countries were doing this, even the Netherlands, they were doing this, but they were quietly doing it because the U.S. was making so much noise about the war on drugs. And on an international level, on a global level, they had to kind of be quiet about that because the U.S. has all this influence and they use their influence with their aid and so forth. And now in the U.S. with cannabis, one of the things that we're seeing by liberalizing cannabis laws is that we're looking at this revenue cannabis is generating, legal cannabis is generating, and we're making calculations. Are we making more money with the cannabis being legal or the war on drugs? And that calculation will determine where we go. And other states, particularly with COVID, they are seriously considering legalizing cannabis because of the revenue. And so we'll see what wins out. Will it be the war on drugs or will it be liberalizing these drug policies and taxing drugs? That will ultimately be the determining factor.
Do you, Joe Biden is president. He is one of the architects, both of the drug war. He's been in power, you know, pretty much since Patrick Henry's time, one form or another. But when he was a senator in particular, he pushed a lot of drug, drug prohibitionist legislation. He helped create the past legislation that created the drug czar's office and things like that. He's also an architect of mass incarceration in the United States. Are you optimistic that he'll be a good president when it comes to questions about drug legality?
Am I optimistic about Joe Biden being good on drug policy and so forth? Not no, but hell no. Joe Biden, he doesn't know this issue, doesn't care about this issue. That's why my attention is focused on the people. This is a book written for the general population, and the general population will dictate what position the politician takes publicly. As you know, Vice President Kamala Harris advocated for legalizing cannabis nationwide. She wasn't always that, didn't always have that opinion, but she's like any other smart politician. They understand the mood, the current mood. And so she's going with the flow. And so the goal, or my goal, is to educate the public, so that they will bring the politicians along with them. And the politicians will follow the public on this.
What do you think the role of, you know, compared to, you know, certainly 50 years ago, but, you know, even 20 years ago, people in America have, you know, we're using more legal drugs. You know, everybody's medicine chest is filled with prescriptions. You know, that just weren't as widespread as before. Do you think our kind of cultural comfort level with taking prescription drugs or drugs that are good for you, does that have a positive effect on saying, well, you know, maybe, you know, if, and obviously OxyContin is one of these, you know, vilified drugs, but, you know, if a legal opioid helps me get through some pain, maybe the illegal Cognate is also, you know, it's not so bad. What do you think the role of the expansion of kind of pharmaceuticals in everyday life have had on the drug war or attitudes towards drugs?
I think it has helped with the education of people. Like, people didn't realize that morphine and heroin are essentially the same drug. I mean, now people understand this a little better.
Adderall and amphetamine.
Exactly. Right? Adderall, the major ingredient, is amphetamine. So people understand this now a lot better. So that helps with the public education. I think that's a good thing in terms of increasing public education around these substances.
Do you worry, you know, and I'm thinking back to substance like LSD, which, you know, as you were saying, you know, one of the ways that you vilify a drug is by linking it to an out-group. And, you know, it could be blacks and cocaine, Mexicans and marijuana. It was kind of youth culture and LSD in the 60s. And then you had cases of, you know, like the Diane Linkletter story, where she supposedly it turned out not to be the case, but she was supposedly taking LSD and jumped out a window. Or you have something like Len Bias, the University of Maryland basketball player who's drafted by the Boston Celtics and died from a cocaine overdose. Are there situations like that that could happen that would derail a kind of rethinking of drug prohibition now?
I think that those situations are, they're going to happen. They're going to be people who get in trouble with substances. The real question is the real point is that we can't take that anecdote, that outlier, and let that influence what's going on with the larger public sort of movement. But we can be sure that someone will be said to have died from a drug-related overdose, like the whole Lynn Bias thing. I still don't know what happened with Lynn Bias. I mean, we give cocaine in our laboratory here at Columbia, 1,000 doses a year, thousands of doses a year. Never have seen these kind of problems. The problem is that we don't really demand that we get a comprehensive sort of autopsy, chemical analyses about what was in the person's system. We test for a certain number of drugs and that's it. We don't know about the adulterants. We don't know what was going on there. At least I don't. I've been trying to really investigate this. I get parents who send me their children's toxicology who have died from what was labeled a drug overdose. And I look at the levels that they're talking about as inducing or causing this overdose. Nowhere near the levels that would be expected to produce an overdose. But there it is on the death certificate. And so it's like, well, what's going on? Well, I think there might be other compounds there that we don't know or something else is going on. But I know these levels of cocaine that you gave me here won't induce the kind of effect that you're saying that happened here.
You know, what are the kind of bullshit detector criteria? Can you share? Because a lot of people, we read about drug scare stories all the time. Somebody dies, or a new drug of choice, is announced in the press. It's methamphetamine, then it's heroin, then it's a prescription opioid, then it's marijuana, which is stronger, than your father's marijuana, et cetera. What are the kind of things that people who want to be critical readers of drug prohibitionist accounts, what should they be looking for?
Whenever they start to see something that say, we have never seen anything like this, this is more addictive than anything we've seen, get ready to be told some bullshit. That's number one. Or if you hear or you see some report, some story about this drug being more addictive than anything we've ever seen, one hit you're addicted, or a few hits you're addicted, bullshit. Addiction by definition requires that the person put in work. That means multiple occasions. When people say that this person died from a drug overdose, the question that people should ask is, how many drugs was in the person's system and what were the levels? If you ask those questions, those are the only questions you ask, and the people who are telling you that they died from a drug overdose, they now know that you know something, and they will be less likely to continue this nonsense, at least with you.
Who were your intellectual inspirations to start this, kind of line of inquiry? Because it's driven by science and inquiry, but it's also, it is so contrarian and heterodox. Who are the people who kind of got you thinking in this direction?
Oh my God, I have so many intellectual heroes. It's just so many. I mean, I think about, we can go, I'm just going to start in the 1900s, and I apologize for folks who came before, but I think about Upton Sinclair, the jungle, that sort of thing kind of really got me to thinking about what's in our foods and what's going into these products and also workers' rights and the people. People like him, they influenced me. James Baldwin.
Yeah, talk about Baldwin, because you cite him in the book and a particular kind of appearance that he gave in the 80s where he really kind of rocked your world.
Yeah, when I think about writers in general, and I think about what writers have to do, it's such a hard activity to sit there and struggle in front of your computer alone in the dark hours. I know anybody engaged in serious writings, I know they are using some sort of psychoactive enhancement, whether it's caffeine, whether it's cocaine, whether it is amphetamines, whatever it is, I know, because if you seriously engage in this activity, you cannot do it. You cannot do it. And so I started to really pay attention and listen to James Baldwin really carefully. Now, James Baldwin, of course, was Black, homosexual. He had all these strikes against him. He wasn't about to come out as a drug user. So there's no record of this, but I'm pretty certain that he did some things in his life, along with a number of people that he was a colleague or a contemporary. Lorraine Hansberry, she talked about when she had cancer, she talked about her love of the opioid Darvon, I think is what she was using, along with alcohol. And so I watch and I listen, and I also value what contributions these people made to our society. And so they helped me to really question what's going on. And not only that, since I'm a pharmacologist, it's incumbent upon me to say what they couldn't say. And so that's they made such a contribution, one that I can't make. This is where I can make a contribution. And so I'm trying to just follow their example.
I have cheated, and we were talking about Oscar Wilde, of course.
Thank you.
I we're having some kind of, 50-something brain kind of seizure not to remember Oscar Wilde. But
I know.
What in, a year from now, what do you hope that your book, Drug Use for Grownups, has accomplished?
I hope that it spurred a conversation in every American home, whether they agree or disagree, but I hope it spurred a conversation, and I hope it spurred some people to go and read about drugs who otherwise would not have. And once Americans actually read something, if they read this book, they will see that, hold up, something's very wrong. This is very inconsistent with being what our idea of being an American is. So that's what I hope. I hope every American household is having this conversation.
To follow up on that, your patriotism, and I think that's the right word for it. And you've lived a patriot's life. You are, you served in the military. You're speaking your truth now in the name of liberty for all, and that is a really recurring theme. Why did you join the service?
I joined the service originally because I didn't get a basketball scholarship that I thought I would get, and I thought I'll go to the military and I'll complete some college courses there, and that way I can get a degree without having to pay much money for it. That's the main reason, but. Just like many Americans, I was brought up on that patriotic, those jingoistic sort of phrases. And at the core, I want to be a proponent of this liberty and justice for all. I really believe in it because it's the only thing that I really have to believe in. The world is watching us. All of these countries look at our Declaration of Independence. And I understand, particularly with the current administration, how fragile this democracy and any democracy is. I really understand it now. That's why I really hope that people really evaluate what the Declaration means. It's a brilliant document. And I wish we taught it at the college level more so. And it's wasted on those young people in school. It needs to be taught at Capitol Hill. In Capitol Hill, I don't think they understand what it means.
So, if we end the drug war, there's at least two major effects, and I guess I want to get your as a final point, your sense of things. One is that if we end the drug war, we kind of demobilize the entire carceral state, and that means cops are no longer looking, checking people's pockets and doing stop and frisk on all sorts of levels. Prisons are emptied out and people can go back to work and they can be more there's that element to it, which is huge. You know, suddenly people have a lot more free time to actually do something productive rather than try and control people. But, and then the flip side is that we would actually have more intoxicants, and maybe that's the wrong word to use, but more drugs that would allow us to become who we want to be or to relax or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about how that, you know, opening up the pharmacopoeia, legal and illegal, getting rid of this idea that there are licit and illicit drugs, how does that play into your vision of an America that is really based on liberty and freedom?
It would just be consistent. We have a number of areas in our country where we're not consistent with this idea of liberty and the pursuit of happiness. When you have these areas where you're inconsistent or you're living inconsistent as a country, you give people more of a justification to criticize you, to not participate in your democracy. So it would help to minimize or at least take away some of those inconsistencies. We still won't be a perfect country, but we'll certainly be on the way to living up to our ideals. So that's how I see it. I think that many people currently are enjoying the substances that they love. But those people are those people who have many resources. They are in the know. They are privileged folks, while other people are suffering. And I just want to make sure that everyone has access.
Right. Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Carl Hart, Dr. Carl Hart of Columbia University. He's the author most recently of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Carl, thanks for talking.
Thank you for having me.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.